This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And on this day after a middle-of-the-week Christmas, we know many of you are still home taking a holiday pause, while many of you, including me, are back at work looking ahead to next year fast upon us. We begin today with a story of 2013 about the power of love that not even an act of Congress could deny. The U.S. Supreme Court on June 26th of this year ruled that the love and freedom of 84-year-old Edie Windsor was something that was protected in the U.S. Constitution. Back in 2007, Edie Windsor married Thea Speier, her partner of more than 40 years, in Ontario, Canada, something she could not legally do in the United States, partly because of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, passed by Republicans and Democrats in a very different political time in America during the 1990s. But when Thea died in 2009, she left her estate to Windsor, and Windsor tried to claim a federal estate tax spousal exemption. But because of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, the government claimed that Windsor owed thousands of dollars in estate taxes because her marriage was not recognized. Windsor sued, claiming that the Defense of Marriage Act violated the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. Edie Windsor took on the U.S. government and won last June in a 5-4 decision. We begin with the love story of a talented, bright star who rose in the world despite her sexual orientation, who spent most of her life in the closet, but when she directed her intelligence, wit, and determination on the U.S. Supreme Court, she became a star who changed the world for millions of Americans.
It's like there's a huge love affair between me and the whole gay community, and I can't walk down the street without people stopping me to say thank you. It's thrilling, you know.
Did you ever expect that you would be such a symbol?
No, not at all. At some point I had said to Thea, you know, oh, God, look what we've accomplished. What would have happened if we hadn't used up so much energy just being hidden? And first she said, oh, that's, you know, it doesn't bother me at all. By the time we were through talking, we were both crying. So I already understood what, you know, the price we paid. And yet we had a very good life. We were wildly in love and stayed that way.
Tell me about your courtship.
Well, it didn't even exist at first. I mean, we met, we danced together. We then danced together from time to time as we met at parties. She was always with someone.
She was the first lesbian dancer, you said, who knew
who could really lead. And that mattered. That did matter. but other than that, there was about 2 years went by where we were nothing else to each other except people who danced together when they met at parties. And then we began seriously dating. And then we became engaged in 1967.
And still the hiding went on, even though as far
as
you were concerned.
Yes, no, we had a world in which we were not hidden, you know, a gay world. And then we both had some friends who were straight and who knew, but it was never explicit.
Speaking of explicit, you're a very sexual person, right?
Yes, and certainly was with her.
And to the point that your lawyer even advised you, you know, stop talking so much about sex.
Don't talk about sex,
right.
Yes.
But in some ways, your exploration and freedom about sex mirrors the freedom that you demanded in this court case. Do you think sex and freedom go together?
Probably. Okay, mostly. And yet, I think if you're in love, sex is there, and it doesn't have to do with freedom or not freedom. If you have to be free to be in love, then that's true.
But there's certainly something about your relationship with Thea that liberated you.
Yes. Yeah, completely.
What was that?
I think we were so pleased with each other, so we had to be pleased with ourselves. It made for not feeling hidden even when we were. I know, at IBM, I never told anybody I worked with, and we were all very close. We were a strange group, but we were all friends. And we had lunch together, we drank together after work, except I didn't go anywhere with them on weekends. And most people did not realize I was gay until our wedding appeared in the New York Times. And then people called up and said, you lied. Edie, you lied. Okay. And I said, I had to.
Why did you get married in Canada?
Pardon me?
Why did you get married in Canada?
Oh, there was nowhere else. Okay, we waited. We really were waiting for New York, but we waited for New Jersey. We waited for Connecticut. Massachusetts, you know, you had to be a resident. We weren't ready to leave New York. And I had asked her, you know, did you want to go to Canada? And by then she was fairly crippled with MS. And she said, not really, but if you want to, you know, if it matters to you, we'll do it. But then what happened is she had a lousy prognosis. And she got up the morning after they said, you know, probably a year to go. And she said, you still want to get married? And I said, yes, I do. And she said, me too. And we went with two best men and four best women, all of whom had functions to deal with, okay, the equipment that was missing.
Wheelchairs,
okay, somebody
walkers,
to
scooters,
lift her, somebody yep, for yep, carrying her, somebody right, to hold her hand out so I could put a ring on it.
So you were domestic partners.
Yeah.
And it just felt like a disappointment.
It didn't. It was nothing. It didn't matter. It was a symbol of who we were to each other. I mean, no question. And we loved it that everybody was sweet, you know, and we had big bouquets and what have you. But it wasn't the same as the morning after we got married, okay, and woke up. There's a profundity that it probably goes with the word even altogether. But I think it's much more so for those of us who really thought we could never have it. So, yeah, we were a little delirious, and it was an extra thrill, but it is different. And I ask every single long-range couple who has gotten married since it's been possible, did it feel different the next morning? And every single couple says yes. Mm. Okay.
Can you describe the moment when you understood the discrimination that was being forced upon you after Thea's death? And the moment that you decided, all right, we're taking this all the way.
Well, I think I always knew it. And I was one of the people who, when we bought our apartment, which grew in value over 40 years, incredibly. But when we bought it, I was very careful to make sure we each wrote half the amount in the checks. Not only that, I saved the check, the records. Okay, I saved the list of each of our things. Okay, because I know someday they're going to ask me to prove where the money came from.
Yeah. So you're not an ideal plaintiff. You're a dream plaintiff. You had all the documents, all the check stubs.
Yeah. But that was for when they say, hey, you have to pay for everything. Okay, we wouldn't have to.
So when did you think this was going to the Supreme Court?
Shortly after the appeals court. The appeals court was the glorious surprise. There were three judges, one of whom, a very conservative guy, the Chief Justice, and a Clinton appointment and a Obama appointment. The Clinton appointment wrote something like 43 pages in dissent, and the conservative Chief Justice wrote the most gorgeous, more giving and more open than the Supreme Court.
Were you comfortable during the arguments in the Supreme Court?
Yes, completely, completely.
But there must have been something intimidating about United States versus Windsor.
But the first time I saw it, it was terrifying. The United States, it wasn't the United States versus Windsor to start. But initially it was Edie Windsor versus the United States of America, and I panicked for a moment, and then just it was okay. And, of course, very soon, you know, the president and the Justice Department announced that they would no longer defend that law because they agreed with me that it was not constitutional. So that was a big help.
What did you feel like during those arguments? Did you feel the court was with you? Did you feel the justices were with you as you looked from face to face?
That's hard to say. I felt they were very fair and very respectful, which surprised me. Of course, the four liberal justices were obviously on our side. Pretty much you could count on that. And then Justice Kennedy, at some point in the middle of the thing, he made a reference to 40,000 kids in California. And I thought, oh, God, we have it made. I mean, he was defending the need, okay, for marriage.
Was Thea there in court?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, people ask that, and I thought, what a silly question. But yes, she was. Actually, I find notes from time to time. I find various things in drawers all over the apartment. And I came home, and I swear to you that it was the day that of the oral arguments at the Supreme Court that I found a note that said, you did it, honey. Congratulations. Okay, from her. Now, she hadn't been able to write for years. So I assume it was probably something like when I stopped smoking. But you know, I thought I was spooked. Okay, I have this note.
And she's still talking to you, right?
Yeah. I think she would be thrilled. Okay. One, she would be very happy that I'm out there and happy, because what this business of this love affair with the gay community is makes me a very happy girl. And you know, if you have to survive a great love of your life, it's a wonderful way to do it. It really is.
Well, Edie Windsor, thanks so much.
And thank you so much for having me.
Edie Windsor was the plaintiff in U.S. v. Windsor, the Supreme Court case that struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. Later this hour, the broader implications of the changes in 2013 for gay families in states coast to coast. We'll talk with Professor Dale Carpenter of the University of Minnesota Law School.
There was a sea change at three levels: in American politics, in American law, and in American public opinion on the issue of same-sex marriage.
For many of you, your year has been an echo of plaintiff Edie Windsor's triumph. We live in San Francisco, where good friends were finally able to be married after the Supreme Court decisions for the large local and vocal gay community. It was a very uplifting and affirming year to be rid of Prop 8 and DOMA, a big step forward welcoming all our citizens into full citizenship. And one of you from New Jersey: my fiancé and I have been waiting for marriage equality not only on a state level, but on a federal level as well. Now that we have seen both DOMA and the state of New Jersey fall into place, we finally can get married and have a child and have the protections in place for everything.
Hi, this is Daniel from Dallas, Texas. Unfortunately, the advancement in the civil liberties and rights of the LGBT community has not impacted me directly, as I live in Texas, and under Texas law, I am still able to be legally fired for my sexual orientation.
And here, one of you from Portland: as a transgender person in Oregon, I have felt the positive impact of local changes, but nationwide and in the military, my trans brothers and sisters have a long way to go. 2013 meant a lot of things to a lot of you out there. What was your standout moment?
Hi, my name is Rosemary Cabrera. My memorable moment for 2013 is graduating from the University of Central Florida with a bachelor's degree in criminal justice at the age of 55.
Hi, my name is Jude. I'm calling from Norristown, Pennsylvania. I just want to be thankful for seeing my dad. He was in a hospital for about 2 months this summer, but that he's out of the hospital and he'll be celebrating Christmas with us this year. So that's one thing that I'm really, really thankful for 2013.
Congrats to Dad and the graduate. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your moment of 2013. And later this hour, actor Tony Hale reflects back on a more than decent year for a working actor. Two hit roles.
I mean, they're definitely very, very similar and both incredibly vulnerable and could use 24/7 therapy.
How Buster in Arrested Development and Gary in Veep have more in common than just the actor who plays them. That's coming up later this hour here on The Takeaway.
They put me on the cover of their magazines. Scarlet skies and broken dreams. They promised me that we would change the world. For better or for worse.
Changing the world is a theme of the band Hypernova's album American Dream, one of the voices of Iran emerging in American pop culture. This has been a year of change for Iran politically, with big implications for the U.S. and Iran that will play out in landmark nuclear talks in 2014. The election of President Hassan Rouhani was a big change from his predecessor Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And in a land where technically you can get in trouble for carrying a Christian Bible around, President Rouhani tweeted a Christmas message this year. Quote, "May Jesus Christ, Prophet of Love and Peace, bless us all on this day, wishing Merry Christmas to those celebrating, especially Iranian Christians." That tweet is as powerful a sign of change as the confrontational music of the band Hypernova, co-founded by Iranian exile King Ram. In a series of conversations with ordinary Iranians who sense that change is coming, Ram says his voice is the voice of music that long divided Iranians and Americans share as common ground.
From the very first day when I came to the States and all the interviews that I've done, I've always sort of, you know, made the point of, you know, rock and roll has no boundaries. You know, music brings us together. It transcends race, religion, boundaries. And the more I travel around the world, the greater, you know, I realize how our similarities are than our differences.
You know, we spoke with a designer recently who's gone back to Tehran to resurrect the Paykan car. And one of the things that he said was that the connection between car culture between the United States and Iran transcends politics, transcends all of this. You're saying music transcends politics, transcends all of these sort of divisions between peoples. Why do you think there can't be more of a sense of collegiality and community between the U.S. and Iran?
We definitely have our historical, you know, back and forth. But generally speaking, when you see like all these sort of negative, you know, this hateful sort of image they show of Iran towards the West, it's such a, I would say it's such an unfair sort of assessment of what I think the majority of people actually feel over there. I'm not saying that they're not religious or traditional, you know, in the sense, but every time I've had American friends come over, you know, to visit and say, maybe like, they would have nothing but good things to say about, you know, their trips and their travels. And I think the way that Iranians are portrayed in the media, I think is a little unfair. And this misconception can lead to, you know, people feeling that, oh, these people are like savages or this. And it's very unfortunate because, you know, in the Middle East, you know, Iran is like, I think, one of the most sophisticated and technologically advanced countries. You know, we have the highest rate of women in universities, a very thriving art scene. You know, you have performance artists, galleries, painters, sculptors, and just given the limitations that all these people have back home, they still find ways to be creative and interesting, and they continue to inspire. And I think that's really the most important thing for me about art. And there is a real sense of honesty and sincerity in the work that they do back home, because that's all they have. The same thing was for us. When we would play music in the undergrounds in Iran, that was our release from the chaos and madness around us. It was our escape into this fantasy world, you know, and even
how,
to this.
How can you say madness and fantasy and yet express so much pride about Iran at the same time? I mean, you go from one sentence of pride, one sentence of kind of anger. You know, it sounds a little bit like a Democrat speaking during the Bush administration.
You know, that's a very interesting point you actually mentioned. I do find that we do have this sort of inherent sort of paradox within us as Iranians. There is a sense of, you know, pride and nationalism, and yet we're conflicted given the nature of our sort of oppressive government. You know, the way that we were raised and since the revolution, I think one of the biggest causes for this issue that you put a point on is that we learned to live this sort of very bipolar lifestyle. We were taught to say and do one thing in public, and we would do the exact opposite in private. So imagine as a child, you know, your parents are telling you to lie at school, and their teachers are asking all these questions that, you know, you're confused about. And you grow up with this attitude. So this becomes like second nature to us in a way, where we have this love-hate relationship with our own country.
If your parents ask you to lie at school, give me an example of what exactly it is you're talking about there.
Well, it's very fun because, you know, like, you know, in Iran, there's, you know, people, they drink alcohol. There's a lot of alcohol consumption, and very like much to the prohibition where it's illegal, it's even more accessible. I mean, both alcohol and drugs, it's crazy how easily accessible it is.
Right. But so what you're telling me is like, unlike in America, where it would be the parents would rat out the kids for drinking.
Right.
It's the kids who are protecting the parents from being found out.
I mean, they would apply very Orwellian techniques. Remember how, like, they would get the kids to spy on the parents, to tell the kids to, are your parents drinking? Are they playing cards? Are they listening to, you know, Western devil music? You know, it's so this is like the sort of environment that you grew up as a kid. So you're very confused.
That's, but, you know, completely wild.
But this whole idea that, you know, we've always been raised with this sort of religious context where we were forced to do a lot of things that we didn't want to do. You know, I remember like we were forced to have to go and pray every day. Nobody did. You know, nobody ever went. And I think it's gotten to a point where people, instead of having that positive effect on them, it's going the exact opposite way. Hmm. And Iran is, in a way, is a strange clash of old and new. Where you have, you know, technology and, you know, internet and satellite bringing in all this Western lifestyle of, you know, what's hip and cool, et cetera. But at the same time, people are still like, you know, they're struggling with some traditional ideals and conservative values. So it's very interesting the way that this whole thing is playing out, because the majority of our country is like over 65% is under the age of 35.
Right.
Which is pretty fascinating. So, you know, I think slowly but surely we're going to see like, you know, some very interesting changes within our society.
Well, let's do one thing before we go. I mean, you've described how art and music can transcend political divisions. What if we made a band, right, with President Obama and President Rouhani and maybe the Supreme Leader and, you know, John Kerry or somebody from the U.S. government, Hillary Clinton or something like that? What would each one of them play, do you think? Who'd be the DJ? Who'd be the vocalist?
That's such a funny question. I don't know. John Kerry, because he'd definitely be the bassist. He just seems like that type.
Totally.
I guess I could totally see Khamenei, because, you know, he only has one hand. So he could be like the Def Leppard drummer. He would work well. And between Obama and Rouhani, I don't know who would be. I think, you know, Obama has actually proven that he's a pretty good singer a couple of times. So I would definitely, he'd have to be singing. And we'd put Rouhani on lead guitar. I think his outfit would just be really badass.
I'm totally with you. King Ram, thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you for having me, John.
32-year-old King Ram is the founder of the Iranian rock band Hypernova. You can hear our other conversations with Iranians about this year of change at thetakeaway.org, including Shaheen Armin, a design engineer who's part of a movement to celebrate the Paykan, the classic Iranian car from the time of the Shah. One person caught in the continued tension between the U.S. and Iran, even in a moment of change, is former U.S. Marine Amir Hekmati, who was detained while visiting family in Iran and has been in jail for the past 2 years since before the election of President Hassan Rouhani. U.S. Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee of Michigan has been fighting hard to get him out. Hekmati's conviction for espionage and his death sentence have been overturned, but he remains in Tehran's Evin prison. Sara Hekmati, Amir's sister, joins me now from Flint, Michigan. Welcome, Sara.
Thank you for having me.
Do you think that your brother is a pawn in the current nuclear talks between the U.S. and Iran, or are his problems deeper within the Iranian judiciary, from your view?
You know, it's hard for me to know and get in the politics of it. We're just a regular family, and for us to really understand everything that's been going on has been so daunting. I mean, we've heard things like that and we've been told that, but to really know what's going on, it's just very vague and ambiguous.
When you say you've been told that, if you don't mind me pressing you, have you been told that by officials close to Secretary of State Kerry?
No, just from experts that have been familiar with these types of detainments and understanding what's going on.
Is the presence of the United Nations here? And explain, if you would, how they're going to sign up to be a part of the calls for your brother's release. Does that help?
I think it builds international awareness, and I think it can't hurt. And I think that knowing that the international community is watching and that there's a report out there that his case has been investigated by one of their working groups is definitely something that we feel is hopeful for his case.
What is the last contact you've had with your brother, if at all?
As far as direct contact, it's been through family that has been able to visit him, and he's been able to send some letters to our family here in the U.S.
Any sense of his condition, his morale, his spirit?
I mean, it fluctuates. He hears that there's going to be a list of prisoners that will be pardoned, and then, you know, we hear that the momentum is moving, that there's better relations with the U.S., and he keeps holding his breath and hopes, but I know his morale is going down because it's going to be almost 3 years now and there's no resolution to his case. And I can only imagine, as frustrating as it is for us, how it is for him just sitting in a cell, not understanding what's going on with his situation.
Now, it's my understanding that he was visiting his grandmother when he was detained.
Right. He had gone to visit his grandmother and was there for 2 weeks. And it was his first trip. He was born and raised in the U.S. He had never been to Iran. So to go, and he spent 2 weeks with family and was basically just picked up and taken like close to the time that he was going to be coming back to the U.S.
How devastating has this been for your grandmother, who must feel a sense of responsibility that the Iranian government has used her as a pretext here?
Oh, absolutely. She says over and over again, if I could look through a fortune ball, I wish he never came. And, you know, she always wanted him to come. He was the last grandchild that had not been there to visit her. And so it was like really devastating. And she often says on the phone to my mom, you know, I wish they would take me instead and send him home.
What's your sense of this feeling of change between the U.S. and Iran before we go?
We're so hopeful, and we really, this is something historic, and we feel that this, the timing couldn't be better for us. If there's a time for Amir to be detained, you want it to be during what the time that the U.S. and Iran are actually talking and having direct talks. Before, for the past 2 years, we had been going through other channels, through other governments that have bilateral relations with Iran. And so now there's an actual direct way for them to communicate. And that's really good for us.
A sense of hope from Sara Hekmati, sister of former U.S. Marine Amir Hekmati, who's been held in Iran for more than 2 years. Thank you, Sara.
Thank you so much.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A worsening situation in South Sudan has caused the United Nations to vastly increase the number of peacekeepers in the world's newest nation to well over 10,000. The United Nations estimates that thousands have been killed in the past 11 days of fighting. For more, we're joined by Hannah McNeish, who's just returned from Juba in South Sudan. She joins us from Nairobi. She's a freelance journalist based in South Sudan. Hannah, welcome.
Thanks.
What will be the role of the peacekeepers who are coming in, do you think, at this point?
Well, considering that the UN has 58,000 people hiding at its bases across the country, and there is fighting that is going on in several states, there's an enormous need for peacekeepers. However, I would like to point out that there are 7,000 peacekeepers already in the country, 4,000 of which are infantry. And yet when I was in Juba, I didn't see any sign of them touring the neighborhoods that I went to where there are dead bodies on the street. I spoke to aid workers there who say that they're not patrolling properly. And so really, you can boost the numbers, but it will depend on what the UN is going to send them to do.
Well, what you're saying really coincides with the language coming out of the United Nations and in other places among the international community who seem to suggest that we've really passed a point of no return in South Sudan, and that this is beyond what a normal peacekeeping operation can even deal with. How would you assess that?
I lived in South Sudan for 2 years. I was there for several massacres of an ethnic minority in South Sudan's Jonglei state. And I heard the same excuses over and over again. We lack the resources. We lack the capacity. We don't have enough peacekeepers. When really, all the only statements I've ever seen coming out of the UN mission in South Sudan is that we are sheltering people. We've opened our doors. To be honest, I haven't seen them take a very proactive role. It was extremely unfortunate. Fortunate that in Akobo, their base in Akobo in northern Jonglei, last week there were two peacekeepers killed and another one injured when 2,000 young men from militia marched in trying to kill their rivals. Of course, the UN can't stop something this big without there being any input from the government, any kind of political will. And I understand that people are preparing to sit down to talk now. So perhaps that will be the end of this conflict. The only thing is that just 11 days on, this has really spread from being a political struggle to spreading to the army, to spreading to militias re-emerging, to civilians turning on one another along tribal lines.
How much hope is there in the regional players here, Kenya and Ethiopia, who are going to play a role now in attempting to mediate with the government precisely the divisions that you've described?
But the analysts that I've been speaking to say that regional mediation really is the key. You know, South Sudan's neighbors played an enormous role during years of talks, which ended almost five decades of civil war with Sudan. So there is real hope. China is also sending an envoy to South Sudan. Now, China relies on South Sudan for 5% of its oil needs and is a major economic player. At the time when there are still fighting going on in oil-producing states, I think that China's weight could also really turn it around.
What about Sudan? Does Sudan
hope that things settle down, or are they in some sense inflaming the crisis, have an interest in inflaming the crisis?
I'm not sure. Sudan has been quite quiet, and everybody is waiting for them to move if these rebels do seize oil fields and hamper production. But it's very difficult to tell. I mean, South Sudan is somewhere where allegiances change constantly. And yeah, we'll find out in the coming days which way the wind blows for Sudan, I think.
Speaking to us from Nairobi and just back from Juba, South Sudan, Hanna McNeish is a freelance journalist. Thanks so much, Hanna.
Thank you.
This is a great year to have been working in television. It's just possible that there have never before been so many ways to work in TV and to score a hit in TV.
You need me just as much as I need you, Cookie.
Oh, really? Because you can be replaced, you know. And even if you can't, you're not the boss of me. Can I go to... I'm going to the park!
Tony Hale as Buster, making a much-heralded comeback on Arrested Development when Netflix rebooted the series in 2013. Hale was already doing just fine as the number one suck-up Gary to Julia Louis-Dreyfus's number two on the HBO series Veep.
Hey, ma'am, thanks again for inviting me to dinner.
Sure.
That's an honor. I actually wrote it in my diary and stared at it for a full 5 minutes.
My treat for you. Would you set it all up, please, and check the menu, too?
Of course.
No, I actually really do mean that. Figure out the restaurant and everything.
Okay, thank you.
Can you get me my throat spray? I need that.
Sure.
You have it? Mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. No, don't sing it with me. That f***ed me up.
All of this success in 2013 has been pretty bleeping disorienting for Tony Hale, who for decades has been a talented actor just surviving gig to gig.
Pretty crazy. Yeah, because, I mean, I've been doing this crazy profession for about 20 years. So, I mean, all I've ever known is gig to gig. And when you're on a gig, you're looking for the next gig. So to have two jobs that I really believe in, I think were super funny in the same year, that was very, very surreal and awesome.
And does it mean that you're now pegged in a box as these characters and all the vast... diversity that you imagined for yourself 20 years ago, that's out the window?
I know. I guess my days for Hamlet are coming to a close.
Stop. Don't talk like that. No.
No. They're definitely very, very similar and both incredibly vulnerable and could use 24/7 therapy. But thankfully, like, you look at Gary on Veep and he's got a spine. I mean, I think his spine is growing as the season's progress, whereas Buster's spine, I think, more and more crumbled as the seasons progressed into where he's, you know, probably just found him rocky in a corner somewhere.
You know, that's part of the commentary on where television is right now, in that these series have an evolutionary track that's much bigger than was the case in the old sort of sitcom world where you try to hit the same sweet spot week after week after mm-hmm. week. I mean, characters really evolve in the kinds of shows that you're involved in, particularly with Netflix and streaming mm-hmm. going on.
Which is really nice. I mean, I think back to Arrested Development, and it was one of those shows that it wasn't, I mean, obviously at the time it was very different than what was being aired, but it required what you're talking about. It required paying attention. I mean, my parents never got it. They still don't get it to this day. but it does require, you know, some thinking. You know, you really have to pay attention. But in comedies, at that time, you didn't really have to. And so it definitely broke that mold if you really had to really think about it and, where's the storyline going? And there were so many storylines happening on Arrested Development. So it was kind of, and also in the fourth season, it was like one big puzzle. I mean, the way Mitch Hurwitz did it, he was just like a little scientist in a lab putting it all together. So that was really fun to be a part of.
You know, there's a genre of characters like these two that you play. And I could think back to like Ted Baxter on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, these yes men forever, emotionally insecure characters. Do you feel that genre?
Yeah. I mean, and it's fun. I mean, I think Buster was on Arrested Development. He was definitely not with us most of the time, whereas Gary is on Veep. I think he's definitely tuned in, but still has, you know, I think he's got a lot of issues going on. But I love the fact that both characters really were very, you know, they kind of tried to see the positive in things, when everything was kind of chaotic, especially Gary, you know, everybody in D.C., especially not on the show, not necessarily all the time in D.C., but on our show, everybody's very negative and critical and harsh and backstabbing. And Gary's just kind of looking at the glass half full, worships Selena, the vice president, you know, is thinking about her outfit the next day and, you know, just constantly, anytime she starts cussing him, he doesn't hear it. He hears just, you know, unicorns and rainbows. he's just always really just trying to be positive. And it's fun to play that character. It's kind of fun to be kind of that different.
I wonder
color.
if there's an edginess about Washington, though, in the sense Buster on Arrested Development is in a safe kind of box of misery all his own, and we don't really have to worry. I mean, Gary is a lot closer to the, you know, nuclear launch codes in Washington on some level. Do you think there are people in Washington walking around who like Gary, who actually could conceivably pull some lever and, you know, change world history?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think the thing about that our show that I do really appreciate is these people who are just, you know, normal people who have as many issues as everybody does, they're put in these really elevated positions. And, you know, I mean, yeah, mistakes could be made all over the time. But it's really like, if you think about it, it's really like high school in a way where, you know, Obama's the popular kid and everybody's trying to get as close to the popular kid as possible because then they feel powerful. So you're finding a lot of positioning and posturing, and you think of politics and everybody's kind of saying the perfect thing and all these great sound bites. But on our show, you kind of go behind the scenes and see the humanity of these people, that they could make massive mistakes, you know, and just because they're, you know, human and we're hoping for the best. You know, hopefully they're surrounding themselves with good people, but they also go behind the scenes and have freakouts. I don't know if that answered your question.
Well, no, sure it does. I mean, Selena Meyer, we can certainly imagine, wants to be president. But does Gary, in a Selena Meyer administration, want to be chief of staff?
Oh, God, no. I don't think Gary wants an ounce of responsibility except to worship her. I mean, he's definitely got some kind of altar at his house for Selena. I mean, I think he just, any kind of, when it comes to policy, he just shuts down. He completely breaks down. But when it comes to kind of, you know, her outfit or if she needs a tissue, he's on it. He's got like Costco versions of what's in his bag at home.
Any contact from people in Washington who either say to you, you know, it's just like this person on my, you know, Senate staff or something like that?
Yeah. Julia was saying that she went, I don't know who she was meeting in D.C. at one point, but people were, when they were talking to her, they would say, oh, yes, this person's like, because there's characters on our show are like Dan, Amy, Mike. And so people in D.C. would say, or Jonah, they'd be like, oh, yeah, he's the Jonah of the office. He's the Dan of the office. He's the Mike of the office. Like these characters are beginning, you know, the personalities match these characters, which is a wee bit terrifying.
Zeitgeist. You've had a good year. You've had a good year when that happens, right?
I am very, very, very thankful for the work. Very thankful.
Tony Hale plays Gary on HBO's Veep and Buster on Arrested Development. It has been a year of social changes in America in 2013 in domains of life that once seemed rooted in some common and inflexible notions of culture and morality. But in the case of marijuana laws and the recognition of gay marriage, where we began this hour, a state-by-state movement is transforming this country at a pace far beyond what could have been predicted even 5 years ago, and in a manner that seems irreversible. The end of the Defense of Marriage Act has been a landmark for so many of you. From Austin, Texas, I got married in Minneapolis to my partner. We've been living together for the past 11 years. I'm from Brazil, and we could not have the same immigration legal rights as heterosexual married couples have until DOMA got overturned. Maybe by next year I'll have a provisional green card, then I'll be able to visit my family, travel, study, and work. All these things have been barred from me during the past decade or so. Today, 18 states and the District of Columbia allow gay marriage. A court case in Utah is the latest battleground. That's compared with 9 states at the beginning of the year. And by a population breakdown, that means that nearly 40% of the country lives in a state where same-sex marriage is legal. Dale Carpenter is the author of Flagrant Conduct, the story of Lawrence v. Texas, how a bedroom arrest decriminalized gay Americans. He's professor at the University of Minnesota Law School. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
So in both gay rights and in drug laws concerning marijuana, we're seeing the power of this state-by-state movement having greater social influence, it seems, than even the federal government and the U.S. Supreme Court. What's going on here? Assess the power of this state-by-state movement.
Well, essentially what you're seeing is the American system of federalism at work, where states try out different kinds of policies. We had states for a number of years try things like civil unions and domestic partnerships. Then a few states tentatively tried marriages. And that allows the rest of the country to see what the effects of those experiments are. And I think most Americans are coming to the conclusion that recognizing same-sex marriage really doesn't harm anyone. And in fact, it does a whole lot of people a lot of good, including children that gay couples are raising. And as that, as those lessons are learned, more states are accepting the idea that they too should recognize these marriages.
And, you know, unlike the U.S. Supreme Court, which often is grounded in an intellectual argument that is detached from local political concerns, in each one of these states, there are electorates and elected officials involved. There are local issues at work here. It's a very tangible issue at the state level, unlike is often the case at the Supreme Court level.
Oh, well, that's absolutely right. In where I live and work in Minnesota, for example, we had a year-and-a-half-long campaign to defeat an amendment that would have banned same-sex marriage as a part of the state constitution. And to defeat that amendment, which we ultimately did, required us to engage at a very direct and personal level with other people in the state and convince them that same-sex marriage was not a threat, that there was no reason to ban it. And it meant confronting questions about what happens to teaching in schools. Does this change anything that churches are required to do? All of those arguments have to be engaged directly. And in the end, we were successful where other states had not been. But I think that's a trend now.
Do you think the implications of the state-by-state approach, and I particularly note Utah, which is a traditionally very conservative state in the so-called family values debate that seems like an anachronism today, do you think this is an irreversible change, or is it a pendulum swinging and it could swing back?
Well, I hate to say that any change is irreversible. If you had done a snapshot 40 or so years ago, you probably would have concluded that by 2013, we would have fully legal drugs in the country, and we'd have communal living and all kinds of changes that we don't have. So you can't necessarily just project out into the future from what's happening now. But there does seem to be an unmistakable trend line in favor of the recognition of same-sex marriages. And I expect that to continue because, unlike with other social experiments, we simply are not seeing any of the predicted harms from the changes allowing same-sex marriage.
You know, your book that I referred to a moment ago, Flagrant Conduct, the story of Lawrence v. Texas, how a bedroom arrest decriminalized gay Americans. You know, that relates to a 2003 case, if I'm not mistaken. And
correct.
It doesn't have much to do specifically with gay marriage. But it's interesting that in some of the recent cases, the logic that Justice Scalia used in the Lawrence case has been pulled forward to become really the logic statewide and nationwide for putting gays and their partners under the protection of the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution.
Well, that's right. I would say in Lawrence versus Texas, Justice Scalia, who wanted to uphold sodomy laws and allow them to continue to be enforced, argued that, look, if there's no legitimate basis for the state to criminalize same-sex relations, then on what ground do we prevent these people from formalizing their relationships in the law, having them recognized? He said, once you take a moral position against homosexuality out of the equation, there's really not a basis for denying these couples the right to marry. The fact that they can't have children as a couple shouldn't be a barrier, because lots of married people can't or don't have children. So that's not a barrier. And in fact, in the Windsor decision this past summer, Justice Scalia specifically said that the court's decision does point in the direction of same-sex marriage in all 50 states in the not-too-distant future. And his words were used in the Utah case that just came down.
You know, what we've been discussing here is an interesting fusion between the sort of moral transformations suggested and predicted by liberal Americans, but also the states' rights mechanisms often defended by conservatives in politics. Do you think that states retain, and the Supreme Court believes that states retain the right to make sort of moral judgments about same-sex marriage in the future based on their own sort of social mores within the state, as is the case in the abortion debate now?
Well, that is the large remaining question. The Supreme Court struck down the federal law, but that still allowed the states to go their own way on this issue. The Utah judgment invokes federal constitutional principles, which, if applied nationwide, would mean that states would not be able to make this choice. And the court said in its own opinion in Windsor that it was important that states be able to make the decision about same-sex marriage. So I think the court could go either way in the future on this issue. It could invoke states' rights and say, look, this ought to continue to be fought out state by state. Or it could say that the love and commitment of two people of the same sex is due the equal protection of the law, full stop, and issue a ruling that's much broader and applies to the entire country. I don't think anybody has the answer to how that question is going to come out in the near term.
So size up 2013 before we go. Landmark year, milestone year, transitional year?
You can use all of those phrases to describe it. It was a sea change at three levels, in American politics, in American law, and in American public opinion on the issue of same-sex marriage.
Dale Carpenter is the author of Flagrant Conduct, the story of Lawrence v. Texas, how a bedroom arrest decriminalized gay Americans. He's a professor at the University of Minnesota Law School. Dale Carpenter, thanks so much and Happy New Year.
My pleasure. Same to you.
We always want to hear from you, no matter what your story. Share it by calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or visit us at thetakeaway.org. Best moment of 2013. Love to hear yours. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.